Good morning. Sorry to cut off the rockabilly influenced music there, but you are listening to WMFO 91.5 FM, Tufts free form, commercial free, community based radio. And it's time to switch gears now and go to some talk and music with Socialist Alternative Radio. Talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. with some pretty unique programming. Socialism straight up, no apologies. Partisans for the working class, for unions, for a fundamental change in society to democratic socialism, where working people and young people and everyone in society, the big 99%, as they say, are able to control their own labor, control resources on an international scale, and plan an economy that will meet people's needs, that will be sustainable for the environment. And all that's impossible under capitalism, if you haven't figured that out yet. And that's what we're going to get into today, is what's going on with the struggle against capitalism in the most general sense, down to very specific ideas. We'll talk about the elections. We'll talk about activities happening around the greater Boston area and beyond. And we hope that you'll enjoy the show. And we've gotten some good feedback on Facebook. Check out Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. Check out Socialist Alternative itself by going to socialistalternative.org, because part of this show, as we've explained many, many times in the past, is not just to provide alternative information from a progressive working class, you know, socialist standpoint. That's very, very important. But we're also here to make sure that people have a way forward, have a way, something positive they can do, some way to not just despair about the state of things, but to actually change things. And that is in the air more, I think. We have polling data out there. More and more people are in favor of socialism. Now, again, how people define that is very radically. It's very, very different among how you know, different types of people, and how the polls are presented and so on. Socialism for us on this show, as I've already mentioned, is basically bringing democracy to the economy, democratic planning on an international scale at the local, regional, national level, over into the international level, of how to use resources to create a society where basic human needs are met, and then more than basic human needs, a society that actually develops the way people choose it to develop, where individual rights and liberties are respected, but even grow to a point we couldn't imagine under capitalism. All the talk of individual freedom and choice under capitalism is complete myth, complete crap. Capitalism is a very coercive, very constraining system. Basically, you will be exploited. You will sell your labor, or for the top 1%, you will exploit labor. You will use labor to create a never-ending short-term maximization of profits. The rate of profit must always go up, despite the destruction to the environment, despite the destruction to human lives, despite the inequality that comes out of that system. And socialism, democratic socialism, which will require revolutionary movements around the world, is about, unfortunately, because capitalists don't give up all that ill-gotten greed and goods without a fight, and they don't give up their power without a fight over the means of production, over how things are made, how things are distributed, and for what reason, for human needs or for profit. Socialists are for things to be made and distributed in a sustainable way for the environment, and made in, for human need, so everybody has a decent life and beyond. And that's impossible under capitalism. Capitalism is a fairly new system historically, but one that's had a lot of time to prove itself. And despite glitzy technology and improvements in certain corners of society and in certain improvements in technology, capitalism has also shown itself capable of bombing those improvements back to rubble and dirt, and creating a situation where one part of the world can be living in, you know, a situation where a certain percentage of that population, the 1% and so on, have access to technology and a higher standard of living than other economic systems were able to bring to bear, but at a great, great cost, at a great, great danger, the survival of the planet in terms of human habitation and withering inequality, just horrible inequality that other systems also had, class systems, but for most of human history, the sort of tribal societies, sort of, you know, primitive communist societies that existed in tribal societies, that you did not have that kind of inequality. And we're not talking about going back to that, because that's impossible given the development that's happened technologically in terms of the population and so on. But I'm just making the point that the vast majority of human history, there wasn't this horrible inequality that resulted from the slave societies, that resulted from feudalism, that resulted from capitalism. You just didn't have that level of inequality or destruction of the environment that you have now. So socialism is about reversing that destruction of the environment, figuring out ways to produce what we need and distribute what we need without, you know, killing the goose that laid the golden egg, so to speak, without killing off nature in terms of human habitability, and also how to produce and distribute things that we need in a sustainable way without exploiting labor. And when I say labor, I mean a human being and human beings collectively with our brains and our hands and what we can do, instead of that being an unplanned, haphazard, chasing, you know, greed, chasing money, and money determining how to make more money, determining what is going to be produced and distributed. We would actually plan that and decide, yeah, you know, gee, you know, childhood development is pretty important. Maybe we should give some resources over to making sure women have healthy pregnancies and children have healthy diets and they have school that is as palatable and important as possible, and not serving the interests of early work training, but the interests of developing individuals and developing society, et cetera, et cetera. All the things that people talk about in shorthand, and for example, these presidential elections, and the things they don't talk about. I don't hear anybody talking about childcare subsidies, you know, like free daycare, which is extremely important for obviously for humanity. And many countries, even under capitalism, have achieved some sort of that, some sort of free daycare, some sort of that level of you know, where at least a portion of the society or most of the society has access to heavily subsidized or free daycare, childcare. But I'm not hearing any of that in the U.S. elections. I'm not hearing anything about the high cost of the military budget, which is a no-brainer. The huge amount of money going to the military that even under capitalism, you could take portions of that and put it into something like free child care, put it into early childhood education, have full federal funding of education rather than this insane and very unequal education based on property taxes and rich communities versus poor communities and rich neighborhoods versus poor neighborhoods. That's insane. That's got to stop. And charter schools are not the answer. That's just corporate welfare that's going to make the inequality even worse. Anyway, you get the point. Socialism is about freeing up resources, human, financial, that comes out of human labor for humanity, for what people want and need. And if you think people are stupid and they're going to go out and vote for, I don't know, free lottery tickets for everybody or something so we can create multi-billionaires with the resources of society, you're dead wrong. You're just wrong. People are not stupid. People are often ignorant and uninformed, but they're not stupid. And they know what is necessary. They know what's fair. They know what people need, what they need. And it's time to make those decisions. That's what the economy should be for, because labor creates all wealth, but labor doesn't control all wealth or hardly any of it. We don't, as working people, don't control what we contribute value to and what we help make, and we should. And that's where the democratic part of real democratic socialism comes from, not what Sanders talks about. Sanders is not a socialist, and he's not even a democratic socialist. He's not even a social democrat, as some people say. He is raising some issues that are good, that are interesting, that are necessary in terms of free education, at least public education, in terms of single-payer health care, which actually we could go further with that, and Sanders is encouraging a tax on working people to achieve that, which is a big mistake. And also, of course, he talks late in the game, but still is talking about $15 minimum wage. And of course, Sanders talks about the whole level of inequality in society and points a little bit to the system. He's certainly not anti-capitalist, but he talks about Wall Street. He implies and actually says explicitly he believes the system can be reformed. That's where a real socialist says, you're kidding yourself. It's been tried many, many times. It doesn't work. The capitalist system cannot be reformed. It has to be overthrown. It has to be replaced because of that basic problem of who owns how things are produced, decisions about what's to be produced and how they're to be produced controls the wealth in society, controls the economy. Socialism is not about caring that much, although it is an example of pathological sociopathic greed. The level of consumption of the super rich, that is a concern to socialists, of course, especially in terms of transitioning to socialism, getting higher taxes out of the rich, getting the corporate tax rate higher and all that as a transition, one that the rich, super rich, and the corporations will only take so far before they call in a Hitler or a Mussolini or somebody to try to stop the movement. And if we're organized well enough, we can stop that from happening. But there are transitional demands and transitional phases in which you try to accomplish things under capitalism as a way to strengthen the workers' movement, strengthen how people feel about struggle. Basically, socialists are for anything that will improve the living standards of working people in the broadest possible definition of working people. That 99% definition, if you want to use that, 99% of the population. But with the knowledge that historically capitalism doesn't allow those kind of reforms for very long, and even in the United States, that kind of post-war upswing phenomena, post-World War II upswing from like 1950, 1973, 74, of increasing living standards for the majority of the working class, especially white working class, not so much black working class, which had to struggle through the civil rights movement. The white working class, along with black workers and other workers, had union struggles that went back to the 40s and 30s. But basically, you had this increasing living standards where capitalism was giving up more concessions than normal in the post-war upswing, faced with the fear of a resurgent labor movement like they had experienced in the 30s and 40s, the fear of a resurgent left, the fear of the civil rights movement and the black power movement. And yeah, a lot of concessions were gained, and they're all being taken back now. And I have some figures about that hopefully we'll get to pretty quickly. But again, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. We're on every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. here at WMFO 91.5 FM. That's WMFO in Medford, WMFO Tufts, freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio, various ways we explain our existence on the air here. And if you want to listen live streaming or go to the archive function in the schedule portion of our website, go to WMFO.org for a computer experience to listen to the show. Now I'm going to jump. This show is interesting because we have an international audience through the internet, obviously. And we really appreciate that international audience, but we also ask their patience when we talk about local struggles. And of course, local struggles will resonate with struggles happening in your country or in other places around the U.S. But we do jump from the very local to the national, regional, international, back and forth. And we do that on purpose. All the struggles are interlinked. It might not seem obvious at one point or another, but it is. So anyway, we'll talk more about the elections soon. But here we are in an election year, and some people like to pretend that that's all that exists, that it's just the elections and nothing else. But life goes on, and there are struggles happening below the radar of the elections, and which unfortunately will not be helped by politicians focused on, from the corporate parties, Democratic Republican parties, focused only on getting elected. They're not going to stop, and more than in a symbolic way, if that, pay attention to a labor struggle or struggle of other sorts of struggles that are going on now. If you've noticed, even during the election period, which, by the way, keeps getting extended longer and longer, as people talk about, it's true, objectively, if you're here in the U.S., you are following politics in the U.S., this election cycle just keeps getting bigger and bigger for the presidential election cycle. So what I'm getting at is that there's a lot going on below the radar of the corporate media at any time, but especially during elections when they're trying to focus everybody and brainwash everybody into thinking that the election is all that matters. And by the way, that's not a, don't misinterpret that statement. That's not a sort of anarchist influenced screw all electoral politics type thing. That's not what I mean at all. Electoral politics for socialists is extremely important for a variety of reasons. I mean, we like voting. I mean, a future social society will be based on all sorts of voting and other decision ways of decision making to be as democratic as possible, and even more democratic than we can imagine under capitalism, where we're used to the strict authoritarian regime of the corporation as in the workplace, or the corporate-dominated governmental structure, despite all the, you know, or the Constitution. When Scalia passed away, they were talking about how he was such a, what was that word? I can't remember. It was something like originalist or something. I think I'm getting the wrong word, but it meant that he liked to go back to the original U.S. Constitution to make decisions about things happening now for the capitalists, obviously. And that was such a joke to me because, you know, this is the Constitution, which they try to make a sacrosanct document, was written by slave owners primarily. You know, it was written in a society where, you know, there was a mix of slavery and feudalism and a few little weeds of capitalism starting to grow. And the people that ran the show in the Continental Congress or before that, were the emerging bourgeois class, the emerging ruling class, off of slave money, off of trade, also hooked into the slave trade in a lot of ways, and the slave masters themselves running the plantations and fighting for more money than they saw no reason to be giving over their profits to England, to the British bourgeois. So, you know, and that's not to say that the normal average person, the small farmer or the growing working class, the small farm laborer or other laborers, that's not to say they fought the revolution for the same reasons, the American Revolution. They had their reasons too, you know, to fight. And some of them, even early on, you know, of course, saw the dichotomy and the ridiculous contradiction between slavery and so-called fight for liberty. But the point is that there was a big, you know, bourgeois rule, you know, revolution to make profits more easily obtained and less taxed and so on, including slave gains from slavery. And then you had them, those same people that ruled that or wanted to rule that kind of society, writing this Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and we're supposed to bow down to that today, and that's absolutely ridiculous. If it had some progressive values in it, which it did have a few, that was a byproduct of, you know, the influence of the common average person caring about those things and pushing for those things. It was an influence of the struggle itself. Here you are, a rich Paul Revere or somebody, but you're forced to fight. You feel like you have to fight. You have to struggle. So free speech becomes an important aspect for you, important tactic for you. Didn't prevent them right away from taking those rights away. They were already taken away from the slaves and Native Americans, but to take them away from even poor whites right after the revolution, you know, the idea of hypocrisy on a governmental level, especially in a capitalist government, is, there's just no end to that deep, deep, dark well. You can just dive forever into the depths of ridiculous and horrible hypocrisy between a government claiming to represent certain values and then in the same breath wiping those values out. We're seeing that right now with the whole Snowden, Julian Assange, the whole idea of civil liberties in an age of, in a time of incredible technology and the whole Apple thing, you know, with the FBI, an age of incredible technology being used to surveil and control and watch people. And so privacy, civil liberties, and so on are really, at a certain level, gone. And people just don't realize it yet. And again, not saying that as a way to say, oh, gee, it's hopeless. I'm just saying that's a fact. Now, whether they can act on all the data they're collecting, whether they can watch everybody and then take appropriate action from their point of view, no, they can't. The movements get too big. They get out of control, even of the best or worst, depending on your perspective, surveillance. But getting back to the Constitution, we're supposed to bow down to this extremely flawed document with just kernels of little bits and seeds of real progressive thought in it. That was Scalia's thing, but that's also what an election period is like. A lot of references to, in the United States, to founding fathers and founding values and all that. There's even a disgusting level of nationalism in the Sanders campaign, and he's supposedly to the left. And he, in many ways, he is not. He was at one time. I followed Sanders very, very carefully, met him, discussed with him a little bit, watched his, ascent and descent from my point of view, from a socialist point of view, from ascent into getting, as an open socialist in the 70s and into the 80s, getting elected as a mayor of a major city, Burlington, Vermont, but then shifting to the right in the late 80s and into the 90s, decisively shifting to the right, where now he's running in the Democratic Party, the corporate, electoral machine of big business, one arm of that, like the Republican Party. And so even his campaign has a disgusting level of nationalism. It's just a little more hidden sometimes. And it's more of a sin of omission many times with Sanders, where he won't mention the bloated military budget. He won't mention a lot of foreign policy issues relating to support for U.S. imperialism, unless pressed, and then he will try to sort of dance around it. But ultimately, a lot is left out, and some is admitted to. Some, he thinks he can get votes by saying he's still for drone strike. He's for drone strikes, that kind of thing, drone attacks. But my original point was, in terms of electoral campaigns, what's the attitude of socialists? We've talked about this on the show before, but I just want to be really clear. When attacking the nature of the system here in the U.S. that's so controlled by capitalism and by big money and so on, it doesn't mean that socialists just turn their back on electoral politics. In fact, for effective and good revolutionary socialists, electoral politics is extremely important. People have fought and died for the right to vote. That is true in a general sense. And also, if you want to get specific about it, it's maybe not the people you were taught fought and died for it. It was other people, actually, more in the civil rights movement and so on than going back to the incarnation of the U.S., where voting rights were very, very restricted to property owners and leaving out much of the small farmers and other working people, leaving out women, leaving out Native Americans, leaving out slaves, et cetera, leaving out immigrants. And a lot of those constrictions still exist through ways of manipulating voting and so on. So there's serious, serious flaws with the whole electoral system. And it's very important for socialists and other progressives to point that out, but not to the extent where you're conceived as saying, oh, forget it, it's hopeless. Because what can you do as a socialist? Let's stick to that. As a socialist running for office, and if you never looked up, if you never heard of Shama Sawant, I really urge you to look up this name. Now, this is a woman from India originally, who's been in the U.S. for a while, and she's a member of Socialist Alternative. She's an open socialist, ran as an open socialist and member of Socialist Alternative for city council in Seattle a few years ago, and won. And despite all odds, she ran against a 16-year incumbent and won. And this was based on people in Socialist Alternative working extremely hard, including getting volunteers and motivating volunteers through our program, through Socialist Alternative's program, a transitional program of demands that people in Seattle and working people in general need. Specifically, one of the main demands that the campaign popularized, Shama Sawant's campaign, was the need for a $15 minimum wage. Once elected, we launched that. We extended that campaign for a $15 minimum wage, led a fight for that, got allies in the labor movement and so on, who proved to be problematic in some ways. But basically, we did end up in Seattle spearheading a victory, the first $15 minimum wage law in the country. And now if you're following that kind of stuff, progressive struggles and so on, you'll know that there are many cities now within a few years that have also adopted $15 minimum wage. The first actual struggle for it was right next to Seattle in SeaTac, which Shama and Socialist Alternative supported. That got hung up in the courts. And then the Seattle one didn't get hung up in the courts. It got hung up in some negotiations and didn't turn out perfectly, but it is basically a $15 minimum wage law that's going into effect gradually. That's the imperfect part of it, but it is already resulted in big raises for tens of thousands of workers and eventually for hundreds of thousands of workers. And it's a brilliant achievement that came out of this electoral campaign. And it's not just also winning an electoral campaign that's important for socialists. It's being able to use electoral campaigns in the good sense of the word to get out ideas and programs that otherwise won't be heard as clearly. Working people have, my personal experience in this and helping with many campaigns, socialist campaigns, and even before that, sort of progressive campaigns. I've never voted Democrat or Republican, but I've worked on campaigns for independence, for progressive independence, and for socialists. I can tell you that if you, say, set up an informational table about socialism or about some issue in an area, and if you hit the issue right, you can get a lot of people there. But normally, it's you're doing sort of just a general outreach type thing, and there's not that much interest. If you do it during a campaign, and it's clear, and you're showing that you're campaigning for somebody, people get very interested and stop by. And even candidates that are not, I'm not saying that you have to put up a popular candidate, even a candidate that's not well known, people kind of have the habit of, oh, that's somebody running for office. I will acknowledge that sign to a certain extent. Some people, I mean, let me, some people try to ignore it, but many people will acknowledge that that's a campaign. They'll put that into a context that they can understand, and they correctly believe voting is important, not for the reasons the bourgeois lectures them about, hopefully, although I'm sure some of them have that in their heads, unfortunately. But voting is important for its potential in a given situation, its potential ultimately for empowerment. I hate that word, so trendy or whatever, but the empowerment of the working class, eventually the real empowerment of people, of the 99%. So an election is an opportunity to get out ideas in a way that's, I think, a little clearer, a little more understandable than normal, although there are other times where consciousness can be really heightened, even more than an election, in terms of a big struggle, big strike or strike wave or something of workers. But elections have their place, definitely, in the sort of ways that socialists try to advance the interests of working people towards, in the case of the United States, and I think in other countries too, towards building a new, or once again building a political party independent of the big corporations, independent of big business, that will be for working people. And there are examples in other countries of parties like that that still exist, but they've degenerated so far from their original revolutionary roots that they can no longer be considered really parties for working people, political parties for working people. And they will not be, they're not up to the task that's out there of fighting austerity, of fighting for a future of socialism, even if they started out that way. I'm thinking of the social democratic parties in Europe, for example. So there's a lot of new political party building to be done, to build workers' parties. And they could be whatever, socialist parties, communist parties, labor parties. The names are important, but it's the program, who runs them, are they getting any money from big business or not? Hopefully not. That's the important part. So, for example, when Shama Sawant ran, she ran without taking any corporate donations. Socialist Alternative doesn't take any corporate donations. And she ran, clearly independent from big business. And not only that, but promised once elected to take only a worker's wage, the average worker's wage in Seattle. And that's what she's done ever since she was elected. And she was recently reelected, which, excuse me, I'll get into in a minute if we have time. Her recent inauguration for a second term, her recent reelection in Seattle, And I was there for a week helping with the campaign, and I can get into that a little bit maybe when we're talking about that. But the point is, that original point was, you know, when I criticize, when socialists criticize electoral politics, it's not from the standpoint of saying ignore electoral politics. I mean, there are times where a certain election might need to be boycotted, but most of the time we're urging some sort of engagement into electoral politics as yet another way to talk to people about politics. And if there's any silver lining to the cloud of the massive propaganda about what's acceptable politics and not by big business during an election campaign in the United States, especially one for president, if there's any silver lining to all that massive billions of dollars spent to brainwash us into voting for corporate candidates, the silver lining is that at least people are talking a little more about politics. And it's important for socialists to engage that. And you don't have to keep it on the level of a horse race. You don't have to say, oh, I like so-and-so, I think they're going to win. You can say, oh, well, that person is bringing up an interesting issue that I agree on, and I'm actually doing work on that, and I'm going to go to a rally next week about $15 minimum wage, or I'm going to a rally against racism, or I'm going to a discussion on how to stop this horrible ballooning, exploding student debt crisis that's happening in the United States, college getting too expensive for all but the elite. How do we stop that? I'm going to this discussion. Come with me. Oh, there's a union over here that's in struggle. This candidate claims to be pro-labor. Well, let's, you know, what really is pro-labor? To go support that. Go on the picket line with the workers. They'll welcome us. They'll like us. They'll like our support, most likely. and we will we'll help them, you know. Maybe we'll raise some money for their strike fund or whatever. You know, there's a lot of ways to use the little horse race discussion happening in many workplaces and you know, other places, community gatherings and so on, to shift it from that to the issues. I think that's the key to do. Whether or not the candidate they're talking about, or even the one you think you know, is going to do anything about those issues, even the rhetoric can be used to a certain extent. You don't want to go too far with that, but you know, it could be an entree into a deeper discussion. Speaking of union struggles, by the way, and we'll get back to electoral politics in a minute, or in a few minutes, or longer, but soon. Here in New England, there is a union representing Stop and Shop workers. That's a large grocery chain called Stop and Shop. And five branches of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union represent workers in Stop and Shop stores in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut. And if you are a friend of their Facebook page like I am, you go into, you get these updates, and it's just basically the leaders of the union saying the company wants to take everything away. They just want to destroy us. They just want to take the contract and rip it up in a lot of ways. And they're still negotiating. That may have changed a little bit. They're negotiating today. They're going to take a strike vote today. It's one reason I'm mentioning it. As of tomorrow, there may or may not be a strike. This is about 10,000 Stop and Shop workers across New England. The company, this is the beginning of the laundry list of things they want to take away. They want to reduce pensions. I would say cut pensions is the more. Oh, I'm reading from the boss's glob, the Boston Globe. So you're going to get all this, like, you know, mealy mouthed, you know, like, you know, reduced in effect, diluted language about what this vicious company Stop and Shop is trying to do to the workforce that enables, that creates the value and enables this company to even open its doors every day. So what do they do? What are these corporate creeps doing to the Stop and Shop workers? They want to cut their pensions. And by the way, before I continue the list, you know, if you live in the U.S., I don't know what it's like in other countries so much, but in the U.S., anyone that works in retail, even unionized workers in retail, make very little money for the most part. There are a few exceptions, but for the most part, this is the lowest wage sector of the economy. Now, that's changing even as we speak. The unions, unfortunately, here have gotten so weak. The leadership so far away from an anti-capitalist, socialist stance or thinking that they just go in and bargain concession after concession. That's the idea. That's how union leaderships think their job now is to bargain concessions and hope the concessions aren't as bad as they could, might have been, or something. This is what my unionership at Harvard just did. I'm in the AFSCME local there, AFSCME local 3650, Harvard Union of Clerical and Technical Workers. So unionership goes in, and basically from day one, they report back very rarely, but they report back to the, and I hear rumors from the to the membership that Harvard University, the richest university in the world, $37 billion in the endowment or something like that, maybe up to $40 billion now, they want to cut our health care. So the union leadership thinks it's their job to go in and try to mitigate the health care cuts and then maybe get a couple, you know, continue to get maybe low token raises, you know. For example, part of my raise structure is a bonus of $750 one year. You get $750, but that's taxed at 40%. Oh, gee. And, you know, that's obviously not as good as a percentage, which I do get a small percentage, like 1.2 or something like that, percent of the hourly rate, you know. So my pay will go up imperceptibly, and whatever I get will be destroyed by the concessions they did negotiate on healthcare, and who knows what other, because there's always other hidden concessions, the way they negotiate in my union, the way the unionship negotiates. So this is a really horrible situation happening in unions all over the U.S., where, like as is the case in my situation, and they the unionship did not try at all to mobilize the membership to put pressure on Harvard University. They did not try at all to get other unions to join us in solidarity to put pressure on Harvard University. They did not try at all to make a strike vote or make any kind of threat of strike credible. In fact, they've based their whole existence at Harvard, the union leadership, same people that have been there 20 years. They have consciously, over 20 years, by the way, consciously told Harvard and anyone that would listen, they don't believe in strikes. And then that doesn't prevent them from telling the membership that, oh, if you don't vote for this concessionary contract, you may have to go on strike. And that's the worst thing in the world, you know. Now, I'll give UFCW, United Fighting Workers, credit. They've already sent work, I hope it's workers, maybe it's just full-time organizers, I'm not sure, sent them out to the, some of the stores and to engage with the public. And that puts pressure on Stop and Shop. Harvard, by the way, like Stop and Shop, is very concerned with its public image. And there's many companies like that. I mean, you have a hard time if you're trying to, you know, pressure some steel plant or some plastics plant or some sort of manufacturing factory that's out in an industrial park somewhere. You can't rely so much on immediate public pressure. It's not a place where people are going to buy something. It's a place where things are being manufactured and shipped to a place where they're bought or sold. Now, question, a very public institution like Harvard, which skates by with paying no taxes, calling itself a nonprofit, which has exists in a city where there are, yes, students going in and out, but also members of the public and faculty and workers like myself, or Stop and Shop that depends on the direct sale every single day of produce, of, you know, all sorts of commodities, food commodities, then they're extremely vulnerable to the slightest, I say both Harvard, it's slightly different, but both Harvard and Stop and Shop, extremely vulnerable to the slightest picketing, the slightest public awareness, the slightest, you know, someone rolling up and deciding, gee, I don't want to have to talk to that person, you know, some idiot that doesn't want to even know about the strike. Well, at least you've turned them away because they don't even want to deal with walking past you. But more importantly, the intelligent worker that wants to find out more, that didn't know about the strike because this stuff doesn't get much publicity, and you can talk with them and get them to hopefully not go into the store, to support the strike, to contact management, say they don't like what's going on, maybe come to the picket line if they're really energetic, that sort of thing. So instead of that kind of obviously ABC of union work, or that kind of mobilization of the membership, pressure, educating the members about the issues at stake, if not the whole system, none of that happens anymore, hardly. It's all about walking in and to management and begging them not to beat us as hard as they could, begging them not to take so many concessions, not take all the concessions they want. Problem with concessionary bargaining is you get to the point where management realizes you're so weak that they're going to bust the union, or try and probably get away with it, or and partially why they can get away with it is because the workers themselves are wondering why the union's not doing anything. The union's not helping me. It's not helping anyone I know. For example, at Harvard, layoffs are always happening. There's no anti-layoff campaign from the leadership. Some workers tried to start one, myself included. There's no attempt to stop the workers being unfairly fired. They can file a grievance, but then you get into this grievance situation at Harvard with the way the union is organized. That's a pro-management forum. It's not really a forum for helping the workers. And the really sad part is I've been there long enough at Harvard. I've been there like 30 years. And I go to run into workers that previously had supported the leadership's concessionary bargaining, not really defending the workers in any real way, et cetera, et cetera. I run into people that were victims of that after defending it. I ran into a worker I've known for years I was just too radical for this person. You know, we got along, but I was just too radical. And then I said, hey, what's going on? Oh, I got laid off. I got fired. Whoa. You know, it turns out they didn't do anything wrong. It was a layoff. Not necessarily firings are legitimate. Most of the time they're not. This person got laid off for no good reason other than they consolidated just, you know, arbitrarily a couple departments and decided they didn't need this person. What it really was is there's a huge level of discrimination against people that are older, people that have been at Harvard for a while, because they tend to cost the company more in terms of benefits, in terms of money sometimes. And so then they're the workers that are targeted, and Harvard will leave around just enough that it would be hard to prove, given the high level of proof you need for discrimination complaints, it would be hard to prove to the state or the federal government that there was a pattern of firing and laying off workers in their like 50s or 60s. But there is, of course. Just hard to prove because they keep some around that are, and the level of proof is so high, you really can't. Go the legalistic route. The union should be fighting the layoffs. Every layoff should be fought, you know. And instead, the union brags, and the union leadership brags, "Oh, we're growing. We've negotiated with Harvard to capture more of the bargaining unit, quote unquote." This is a labor term. More of the workers that work in a certain department are now in the union than weren't, or in a certain area, and that's fine. That's great. But what about the ones you're losing, or that are the workers that are losing their livelihoods through layoffs, through outsourcing, through firings, through, you know, what about the workers forced to, forced into speed up situations because of attrition, layoffs, firings, outsourcing, and not hiring enough people to work to take place of people that leave and all that. So concessionary bargaining leads to more concessions. If you fight hard and you feel like you can't go any further, if workers feel that way and so on, then it's time to say, okay, maybe there's a concession or two. We have to take this time. But hopefully you've dragged the company through a bloody battle that they'll think twice next time they go after you. And that's the only way to deal with bullies. And there's nothing like a capitalist bully, nothing like a corporate bully. That's the epitome of bullying, is the capitalist system itself. It's a system that lives off of coercion, violence, bullying, whether of native peoples or to gain land, or of course the daily, every second it exists, capitalism exploits human labor and nature, and that's not a process that happens smoothly when people are forced into it. Even people that are brainwashed into thinking it's the natural order of things somehow to sell your labor to a capitalist, which is really odd when you think about it, and then do whatever they say, except unless maybe if you have a union, mitigate that a bit. And while the climate is you know, in deep crisis through global warming and so on, while you see homeless people, while you can't get ahead or I can't get ahead and so on, and we all just accept that as, well, this is the way it is. Well, it's not, you know, not to quote Bruce Hornsby in that song, "That's Just the Way It Is" too much, but he was right. Maybe he's a Marxist secretly, Bruce Hornsby. Anyway, the point is that, you know, we're in union struggles here in the United States, it's still very defensive. However, there's still people trying to organize unions. There's still people trying to fight. Some of it's around the 15 now effort, $15 minimum wage, fight for 15, 15 now. Go to 15now.org for more information. Oftentimes the demand is for 15 and a union. But the and union part sometimes gets dropped because it's so freaking hard and complicated in the United States to organize a simple union. I've had so many, I can't tell you how many times in talking to people about socialism and talking to people about socialist alternative and people that newly joined socialist alternative, and we tell them about the history of the labor movement, how important that is, and that it's important to defend unions, to try to extend unions, to try to build unions. And a lot of people will just take that to heart, and they should, and they go out and start to organize a union in their workplace, but they didn't understand, and it's not their fault, but they didn't understand the ridiculous amount and the ridiculously labor-intensive amount of work it takes to organize a union now when there's no broader left movement, no stronger labor movement to help. You know, that you're basically, you're on your own, even if you do a lot of outreach and solidarity. In terms of the real power necessary to stop a company from just moving if they face a union drive, if they're able to move, or to stop them from just trying to smash the union drive because it's legal for a company to fire people. They'll just make up some excuse for firing you. And to be able to stop that requires an enormous amount of power that can't be power generated from one workplace usually. And if even from one workplace, it would be temporary. Usually takes a massive amount of solidarity. So in organizing now, if you're going to organize someplace into a union and it's a place with multiple, say, stores or factories or whatever, you better try to organize a big chunk of them, you know, in one area. So if the company tried to close them all down, it would be too much of a hit. You better have, you know, more than just token solidarity. Here's another thing about the labor movement. I mean, I was at a $15 minimum wage rally in Worcester, Massachusetts last week. And it was, in some ways, it was quite good. Worcester, although it's the second largest city in New England, it's a very poor city and there's not a lot going on politically compared to, say, Boston. But there's some stuff going on, some very important stuff, very important anti-racist work around Black Lives Matter, very important, union struggles that crop up from time to time, and very important, you know, all sorts of community stuff going on. But also this particular thing sort of regenerating or bringing back the fight for $15 an hour movement that actually Socialist Alternative started to get going a couple of years ago there, but we didn't have enough people and weren't able to generate enough interest to really turn that into a huge campaign at the time. We've grown since then. There's been more victories in 15 now and $15 minimum wages around the country since then, many more. And so we feel like it's a good time to get this going again. Some of the unions are involved in Worcester. They're limiting it to a certain category of workers. We're against that. We're for widening it out. Some other unions are for widening it out. Some unions, also other unions than the ones that want to keep it limited, are for widening it out to all city workers. So maybe you'll be hearing in the future about a $15 an hour minimum wage drive in Worcester, Massachusetts. But the point is that this rally, which was pretty good, I mean, we had a dozen members of Socialist Alternative there. It was right after work. It was really strange. The labor leaders that organized it wanted only to be half an hour. So, we showed up and we seemed like to be the only people there. And finally, other people came. This group, EPOCA, I'm mispronouncing it, EPOCA. I'm sorry, it's a prisoners' rights group. They brought some people. But my point is that as far as like bringing people, mobilizing people, the unions could have mobilized easily hundreds of people, right? Even in Worcester, which I think has a lower rate of unionization than, say, Boston and so on. But still, the unions that were represented there through their leaders, SEIU, MNA, Mass Nurses Association, Carpenters Union, Roofers Union, and so on, some of the building trades unions, they could have easily mobilized a few hundred people between them to this rally, you know? And it should be, on a routine basis, mobilizing, organizing more than hundreds. What passes for solidarity these days in the U.S. labor movement, for the most part, there are exceptions, but this happens way too much, is like the president or a full-time organizer from a union showing up to an event or a rally or a protest and, you know, representing their union, you know, talking about their union, giving space, unfortunately, to local Democratic Party hack corporate politician, And then that's about it. You know, they don't mobilize any people. And then there's people walking by, and I'm always like out there, people in Social Alternative are out there trying to get people passing by to join in. And we were successful getting a few people to join into the rally. But for the most part, the wonderful, you know, mailing lists and of their own members and contact information they get from when they do every once in a while support a piece of legislation or something, unions develop and have the, even now in a weakened state, have the staff to really, you know, mobilize a lot of people out to a rally or something for solidarity, and they don't do it. They don't do it. And that trend has been happening for a long time. They just mainly don't do it, and it's really, really sad. Now a situation develops like this UFCW strike. You know, this should be huge. Every union in the area should be sending hundreds of workers to this strike and figure out a way to do that, and it's doable, to shut down the stores if this strike happens. A little more about the Stop and Shop strike. That, as I mentioned earlier, there's a meeting today. I don't know how it went yet. That they may go on strike after today. The company's going after their pensions. They want to increase their health care payments. And this is all on a very low level of, you know, store workers, I know for a fact. My wife Tina used to work in a Stop and Shop. I know for a fact that most of the workers are probably barely aware there's a union there because the wages and benefits are so low. But it's probably a bit higher than in other places that are non-union. And a certain number of workers would be aware, especially older workers, I think, of the fact that because of the union, they have higher wages and benefits and so on. But what the company wants to do is just get rid of that. In other words, get rid of the union, basically, but do this through reducing pensions, increasing health care payments workers have to pay, freeze wages. Can you believe that? Freeze wages. Their wages are already freaking low. And get rid of premium pay for holiday and Sunday work, which is real a gut shot because it is hard. You know, when I first started working back in the late 70s, when I was just a teenager in factories in upstate New York, I was a member of the Bakery Workers Union, and we did have Sunday differentials. We had shift differentials. You got like a little bit more money just for working third shift. And why is that important? Well, think of all the studies that are coming out now and have been for the last few years about how important it is to get a decent amount of sleep and how dangerous shift work is, meaning working night shifts. Think about all the studies coming out about, you know, how the brain functions when impaired by fatigue and all this. I mean, all these things, think about, like, I'm hearing a lot of stuff about the people finally admitting, the scientists finally admitting in some ways, finally becoming Marxists in some ways, whether they know it or not, about how human beings need societal contact. They need that we're basically animals that need contact with our species, you know? And at one reason that these studies are out there, especially in the U.S., because we're the most alienated society ever in history, the United States, the belly of the beast of capitalism. We are so freaking alienated and so violent here that it's just that years from now, if we achieve socialism or even anything close, well, I can't mitigate that. If we achieve socialism, that'll be the only way this would happen. But people will look back and say, how do people stand the level of insanity and mental illness and violence and mass murders and working all the time that they stood? How do they stand it? You know, the poor health care and so on. What the heck was wrong with those people? Well, they were such sheep, you know? And we deserve it in some ways. But in other ways, it's the system, you know, making sure capitalists, you know, using a lot of violence and a lot of brainwashing to make sure things stay that way. And so we have a situation where, you know, like here with the Stop and Shop workers, they get a little tiny bit of money, probably literally like a quarter or something more per hour for holidays and Sunday work, right? Or maybe it's time and a half. I hope it's time and a half. Actually, there's a law in Massachusetts that you have to get paid time and a half you work on Sunday. And I don't know if they exempted retail grocery stores for some reason, because all those laws often have exemptions. There's no really good reforms under capitalism. They're always full of holes, but there's some things that are better than others, obviously. Right now, I'm working Saturdays, for example. It's a short-term thing just to pick up some extra hours. And I absolutely hate it. Oh my God, it's hurting my life so much. Working on Saturdays, working, you know, a 6 day week. And I've, and when I was younger, it was like, and that's why I started to tell that story about working in factories in upstate New York when I was younger as part of the Baker's Union. Yeah, I would, number one, the fact that we had premium, all sorts of negotiated, increased pay for working unsociable hours and holidays and late shifts and third shifts and all that. But, you know, back then I was very anxious for the money to try to, you know, pay for college and so on that was coming up. I took all the overtime I could get, but I also lived at home. I also was very young and could stand it physically. And now as I get older, these long work weeks, which I've done off and on, both in union and non-union jobs, they really get to you. They really start to get to you. And just when you want to spend more time, like with your kids or with your family, you find yourself always at work or traveling to and from work. You know, like right now I have work plus a commute both ways. That's killer. And that's what we had to do to be able to afford a house. You know, I mean, there's no way most working people in this country are faced with rotten commutes because there's no way to afford. If you ever want to get a house for your kids, that's the only way to afford it, basically. Or you're just forced out into bad places where there's transportation sucks anyway. Even when I was living in the city, I lived in Somerville for a long, long time. Even when there were parts of Somerville I lived in, like in East Somerville, where the transportation was so bad that you might as well be out in the country because you had to walk 20 minutes to get to a bus that rarely came. And then, you know, it just was ridiculous. They had it's probably still set up that way. They had everything going. What was convenient for either old traffic patterns or work patterns and what was convenient for the city that is loath to improve transportation. You should see Boston, a city that claims to be a real city. And it has this really rotten public transportation system they're trying to make worse. They're trying to privatize it now. And it's not the fault of the workers. They try to blame it on the workers all the time. It's the fault of just resisting any improvements. And I don't want to get into that. It's a whole digression. But what I'm getting into about, you know, this shift differential work and work for holidays and so on, that's extremely important because it really hurts to live to work, which is what most Americans do, let's face it. We if you're honest with yourself as an American who is able to get a job, but even if you don't have a job, you're probably running around trying to scrape up money in various ways that takes a lot of time. I remember when I was unemployed for a while, it seemed like the slightest errand took a long time, and it was weird. And you know, today I need to go to the store, you know, and that would be the whole day, like going to the store and getting back. And I realized in retrospect, it was because I didn't have any money and I just dreaded going and dreaded spending the money and would try to do weird things to get some money in my pocket to go to the store, you know, like look for money on the ground or figure out who can I borrow money from or when's my check gonna or my unemployment check gonna arrive, how many more days before it gets there, do I have any change I can roll, you know, do I have you know, all these like stupid, you know, can I bring cans back and get a refund, you know, all these things that these little scams that add up to nothing, you know, but you're desperate, so you try them. And you know, so the whole day is spent in, what's the word, fear, in fear of what's to come if you don't find more work, if you can't sell your labor to the next exploiter, you know? So I despise this company. They don't list the company. Stop and Shop probably is run by some other big company. I'll try to find out who that is for next time. I despise them for even touching the workers' premium pay or wages or whatever. Retail's already, they should be embarrassed already. How low the wages and so on. That includes the union leadership, by the way. There's some unions that they kind of really, starting in the 70s, late 70s, but continuing to the 80s, 90s, till now, there's some unions that deliberately go in. You know, they've been called by some low-wage union organizers or low-wage union organizers.